I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 49 of Season 6 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is an associate professor of screenwriting at DePaul University, Scott Myers. Welcome back to the show, Scott.
Great to be here. Look forward to continuing this comprehensive look at one of the key scenes in It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah, just, start making plastics out of soybeans or chili beans or something.
Good business advice.
That's right. It's all in plastics, isn't it? It sounds like that's gradually something else that's been used. Exactly. I was going to say, it sounds like it's something else that's been used often in movies. it's only 20 years later that they used it again. Yeah. Maybe it's just something very cyclical. Maybe plastics is evergreen.
Yeah, have to go through the 80s and see if there were a movie where that was mentioned.
I'm sure there is. I can't think of any offhand. The Graduate was the only one that I can think of besides this one. So, yeah. You stumped me on that one, Scott. maybe it's in K-9.
Should have been in there.
There you go. When you do another remake of it, then Minute 49 begins with Mary making what sounds like a pitch for a commercial for Arid deodorant, and ends with Sam calling out for them to pay attention. So yesterday we ended things with George being very confused, getting ready to leave Mary's house, and Mary calls him over so that they can speak together with their good friend Sam. Sam Wainwright, and at this point, Sam wants them both to listen in, and Mary can't go listen on the extension because her mother is already listening there, even though we saw that she hung it up. But instead, she tells George to get a little closer. She says, "We can both hear. Come here." She nudges him to get closer. So that for anyone who's not familiar with the joke that I made at the beginning of the introduction of this episode, the Arid deodorant commercial. Do you remember by any chance, Scott, the commercials for Arid deodorant?
I remember the deodorant. I don't remember the commercial.
So the commercials were get a little closer, don't be shy. Get a little closer with Arid extra dry.
Oh, got the little rhyme thing going on.
That's right. But the idea was is that, the fact that Mary wants George to get very close here at this point. And then the two of them are listening in on the on the phone extension, and then Mary says, "We're listening, Sam." And then Sam starts explaining his whole idea. He says, "Well, look, I have a big deal coming up that's going to make us all rich. George, you remember that night in Martini's Bar when you told me you'd read somewhere about making plastics out of soybeans?" And then we hear in the background someone goes, "Chili beans." You know, shut up, will you? You remember out of chili, out of soybeans? Yeah. Soybeans, yeah. Well, listen, Dad snapped up the idea, and he's going to build a factory outside of Rochester. How do you like that? Rochester? Why Rochester? Well, why not? Can you think of anything better? He says, "Well, I don't know. Just why not right here? You remember that old tool and machinery works? You tell your father he can get that one for a song. And all the labor he wants, too. Half the town was thrown out of work when they closed down. That's so? Well, I'll tell him." So I know I went through the whole dialogue here, but the conversation just really flew between the two of them. The way that it flows really well, the way that they have it set up here. And we learn so much about these characters just by this dialogue, this conversation that the two of them are having. And I guess that answers the question that we asked yesterday as to why is Sam really calling. He's calling under the pretense that Mary, that he might be interested in Mary, but in the end, he just wants to give them this pitch. He wants to help his friends become rich, which I guess that's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's
Or is
sort
this
of, yeah,
insider trading?
well, he does say to buy up, stock. He's like, in fact that it does become successful, does, suggest that he has, proper motives. On the other hand, if it had flamed out and hadn't worked, then, his friends would have lost a lot of money. It's just interesting that this is the beginning of this conversation. The conversation has a beginning, middle, and an end, like literally, three movements. And this first thing is just on the surface, the text of the dialogue is to set this business thing into motion. But the underlying subtext of it, and it particularly comes out later in some of the dialogue, is the way that it's set up. Mary takes this is from the script. Mary takes the telephone from George and holds it so that of necessity, George's cheek is almost against hers. He is very conscious of her proximity. So
Yes.
all this tech stuff is going on, but meanwhile, there's this physicality, or the smelling and the eyesight and the proximity and the touch. All that stuff is going on. The actors are playing to that while Sam is making this pitch. It's really terrific. It sets into motion everything that goes forward for the rest of the scene.
Yeah, I mean the acting that Donna Reed and Jimmy Stewart give us here is amazing because
That is.
They're supposed to be listening to this conversation, but the two of them are listening more to their hearts as to what's happening between them. They have
Yeah.
their heads against one another. We even see at a certain point that I don't remember if it's in today's minute or tomorrow's minute, but that George looks like he's smelling. He's like
Yeah.
smelling her.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's feeling the intimacy that the two of them are together here.
Yeah, it
That
recalls that their night, together after, I mean, it was 4 years ago, but he's still, it's reigniting those feelings that he had for her in that moment.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, first of all, I like the fact that they have the little shout out here to the fact where Sam says, "Do you remember that night at Martini's Bar?" Okay, so one thing that tells us is that the two of them got together for drinks at some point. Okay, but there's a little bit of a problem here. Do you remember I told you what year this takes place?
Oh, prohibition. This is where we're
This
going.
takes place in
1932.
1932. It's in the middle of Prohibition.
Hadn't thought of that.
So I mean, if they were to say that we were at the speakeasy, drinking, okay, I can
Yeah.
sort of buy that. But once he says that they were at Martini's bar, how was Martini able to have a bar at that point? That's the question that I want to ask. I mean, 4 years earlier, when they were getting ready to go to the party, Peter Bailey has a conversation with Harry about drinking. He says no gin for you.
That's
So
right, no gin for you.
that's right.
That's
But
right.
again, that was also during Prohibition. That's
Yeah. It ended in 33.
right. It ended in December 33. So even if we were to try and stretch it and say, okay, this is the summer of 33, it's not, but they still be another year and a half till it gets canceled. So it's very interesting that they I guess the screenwriters didn't think about the fact that when this is taking place.
Well, I suppose you could, if you really wanted it out, you remember when we went to that night at Martini's bar and had drank Coca-Cola, where we, Martini's bar was just serving non-alcoholic drinks, but no, it doesn't, it certainly doesn't feel that way, and that's a logical inconsistency, but yeah. Who cares?
No. I point out these inconsistencies because it's fun to point them out. But, not because yeah. I'm, you know, it doesn't detract from the movie at all. It's like, it isn't that, the whole plot is based on the fact that they were in Martini's bar, you know, when Miss Scarlet, killed Professor Plum with the rope. I mean, it doesn't matter. It's completely insignificant.
You came up with that other one, which is how did Mr. Potter get up to the second floor of the building alone?
That's right.
He's in a wheelchair.
That's right. I've mentioned that numerous times. But that one I have a great, you heard my explanation for that.
And I
like my explanation. He's faking it.
He just liked being in a wheelchair.
That's right. You know, he wants the sympathy.
Yeah.
You know, that actually makes sense. So, yes. but we learn a lot about these characters. First of all, we learn that Sam's father is a businessman, and he's looking to open up these new businesses, you know, for to give jobs and make a lot of money and stuff like that. So, I mean, we see that both Sam and George are basically going in their father's footsteps when it comes to, you know, finding a profession. You know, maybe you could say that they're under the tutelage of their parents or their fathers.
Yeah, it's interesting. I hadn't thought about it, but Sam is excited to be following that path, whereas George is not at all.
Correct. But again, both of them are this is their destiny. This is where they should be. You know, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier in the week, which means want and need. They both need to be in this place.
Yeah.
You know, they don't necessarily, you know, George doesn't want to be there. But Sam, I mean, come on, we saw yesterday, Sam is living, you know, is enjoying living the life in New York City. He's enjoying, you know, being in the theater district. He's enjoying, you know, feeling important, looking important, acting important, all those things. So,
you know, it hadn't occurred to me, but the fact that there is that quick visuals of Sam in New York later on when Potter makes that offer to George, go to New York every so often, you know, and take the money, you know, that it does kind of create more of a visual reality to that. Like that's mm-hmm. the kind of life that George could have.
But that's so, right.
It's a tiny little visual, but it does, I think, underscore Potter's temptation that he says later on, you know.
Yeah. I mean, again, you know this probably better than I do, but Capra is a very visual director. You know, there are things that we are shown in this movie that, you know, if you're not looking at the screen, you won't know part of what's going on. You know, the whole fact that we were able to see the telegram.
Yeah.
You know, right. Reading the telegram tells us so much. But if you're not paying attention and you don't see that, then you're very confused.
And even the photo of his son.
That's right.
Right, his desk.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Correct. Yeah. Again, there are so many examples in this movie. I mean, I'm not as familiar with other Capra movies, but my assumption is, you know, he follows that through there also. You know, the fact that he, you know, he keeps things very visual. He does a great job giving visual storytelling that helps move things along a little quicker, I guess you can say. You don't have to spend time explaining things if you just can see it real quickly. You know, that type of thing.
Yep.
And so he suggests that they're going to, you know, they're going to build in this factory outside of Rochester. We already know that Bedford Falls is in New York. We don't know exactly where it is in New York. And there is a lot of contention as to, you know, if it's based on a real place or not. So we're not going to go there again because we don't need to go there. But what it comes down to, though, is that Rochester is apparently not that far away. That's the biggest assumption that you can make of that. Do you know anything about Rochester, New York?
That gets a lot of snow, and there's the Rochester Institute of Technology, and doesn't Kodak weren't they headquartered out of Rochester or in that area?
Yes, they were. Mm-hmm. Kodak, Xerox, Bausch & Lomb, Western Union, and then three others I've never heard of: Wegmans, Gannett, and Paychex. Don't know what any of those are.
Gannett, I think, is a newspaper outfit, I think.
Could be. It's also where a lot of the abolitionists began and the women's rights movement. It is known as the Flower City. And ironically, it's known as the Flower, F-L-O-U-R, and the Flower, F-L-O-W-E-R. It's known as both the Flower City and the Flower City because they have much flower production and floriculture there. And also the idea that it is it's also known as the imaging capital of the world because of Kodak and Xerox. So, you know, it's known for many things. Rochester, New York.
Well, it's interesting in this scene that George, you know, he's already confused and distracted, and as we were talking about, sort of upended psychologically and emotionally, given everything that's been going on. And now he's in proximity with Mary, close proximity. And yet, mm-hmm. even here, he says, wait a minute, why not here? Remember the old tool of machinery works? So he's still got that part of himself where he's committed to the local community. That's right. Part of him is an instinct that he has no matter what level of confusion he may be in. He's still thinking about his fellow citizens in Bedford Falls.
Well, I think that's part of the idea here of the personality of George, that no matter what, George always thinks of someone else before himself. You know, he wants to think about himself first, but he just never manages to do it. And, you know, as soon as Sam makes this suggestion, he says to him, wait a second, why don't you just do it right here in Bedford Falls? You can help out all these people that have recently lost their jobs. Don't you think Sam would have already known that also? You know, it's used to help us get a better understanding of what's going on, but it's something that Sam should have theoretically already known, or, you know, because again, if you have the old tool and machinery works that relatively recently closed down and that everyone was out of work. I mean, I don't think we're not talking about something that everyone's been out of work for 20 years. You know, people have been out of work maybe for a few months. That's what I would think. So, you know, I guess, you know, Sam and his father aren't necessarily thinking first and foremost of Bedford Falls.
Yeah, and he's been living in New York and living the high life, and he's got this girl, and he goes to plays, and he's got three telephones on his desk. So, you know, maybe he's not dialed in, or maybe he is aware of it, but that's not his realm of reference.
Right.
You know, he's thinking big. He's thinking, you know, Rochester's a bigger city than Bedford Falls, but not George. George is absolutely thinking about his community.
Right. Well, that's the whole idea. George is, you know, George thinks of Bedford Falls first, as much as he hates it.
You know, it calls back to me, like when Peter is talking to him at that great scene, which you've done, where that final meal together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That Peter does identify something in George that George may not quite understand.
Yeah.
That he does have an instinct for empathy and concern for other people. And Peter tries to make the point that I feel like what I'm doing here, you know, what the savings and loan is doing, is actually doing something of significance. It's maybe not building bridges or skyscrapers, but we are giving people roofs over their heads. And, you know, we are doing it. And that he sees in George a guy who would be able to do that.
That's right.
You know, has an instinct for it.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Yeah, I think it's great the comparison. And that's really good. And then Sam continues and goes, well, that's so, well, I'll tell him. So in other words, it's his father who's making all the decisions here. And he goes, hey, that sounds great. Oh, baby, I knew you'd come through. Now, that's a little strange that he's calling George baby, but okay. Because again, I don't think he obviously didn't expect to speak to George. He was hoping to speak to Mary. So, yeah. You know, maybe
it's a weird.
Maybe he tried pulling George's house. And, you know, George's mother said, oh, he's at Mary's. And, he went, oh, I can catch two birds with one stone.
Well, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that works, except for the fact that he doesn't mention, I tried reaching you at home and your mother told me you were here. But again, or when Mary says George is here, he would have said, oh, I know George is there. Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's probably true.
You know what? Anything's possible. And then Sam continues and goes, now here's the point, Mary. Mary, you're in on this too. And, you know, he wants them to really pay attention. And people are going to have to come back tomorrow to hear what he actually has to say. One thing I wanted to go back on, the phrase that he says earlier, where he says, you can tell your father he can get that for a song. Have you ever heard that phrase before?
Yeah, I have. I know that it means basically for not a lot of money, you know, you can get it for cheap. I don't know why that's how that reference came about, but I imagine you've done some research and can enlighten us.
Yes. So first of all, you are correct. It means getting something at a very cheap price. You know, that's what it comes down to. And it actually originated. Well, we know that the earliest reference to this phrase comes from Shakespeare in his play All's Well That Ends Well. Because he has a quote there that says, I know a man that has this trick of melancholy, hold a goodly manner for a song. And he said that at that time, people would sing on the street for pennies. And that's why they thought of them as being very cheap.
Shakespeare.
Yep. Shakespeare.
God. He originated so many phrases and amazing.
All right. Do you have anything else you want to say about this minute?
Other than the fact that it sets up for tomorrow's discussion, which for my students, I say, if you want a dialogue with subtext, here you go. Just check this out.
All right. Great. So every Thursday, we have a segment called Jimmy Stewart Thursday, where my guests will give their top five Jimmy Stewart performances. So, Scott, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Oh, this is tough.
I never said this was going to be easy. Come on.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'd start with Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, Jefferson Smith. It's a tremendous performance. I did read once when Jimmy Stewart was such a committed actor. He's my favorite actor. Jimmy Stewart was such a committed actor that the legend is, I think it's true, that he would coat his throat with iodine in order to get that raspy thing when he's doing the big speech in Congress. But it's a great performance. Then I went to the Philadelphia Story, Mike Connor. He's a tabloid reporter. It's a wonderful, Jimmy Stewart showing off his kind of romantic comedy chops. There's a great scene between him where he's drunk with Cary Grant and he burps. I think that was, Cary Grant almost breaks at that point. But I mean, that whole scene, that movie is terrific. Of course, you got all the Hitchcock movies, Vertigo, The Man Who Knew Too Much, and Rope, but I went with Jeffries, The Rear Window, because that's such an incredible role where a guy basically is stuck in the apartment the whole time, and yet he carries it. Then I went to The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which is another time where Ransom Stoddard, where he plays a politician who comes back, and that's a really interesting movie with some great performances, John Wayne, Lee Marvin is a bad guy, like a really bad guy. But I'd have to end up with George Bailey. It's a Wonderful Life. I think, if I'm not mistaken, doesn't Jimmy Stewart say that's his favorite role of all time, was playing George Bailey?
I believe
so.
So,
yeah, it's an incredible role. You know, we tend to think of it, it's this wonderful Christmas movie, but it's got a lot of edge and darkness to it. And, you know, he's got some moments in there where you see this rage that's built up inside of him, this anger about being stuck in this place. It's a very dramatic role. shaking Uncle Billy. Where's my money, you old fool? Yeah. So it's a terrific role, and all of them, all these roles I just mentioned are great, and many more, Harvey and others. But yeah, those are my top five.
All right, great. So you want to once again tell people where they can find Scott Myers?
So I have a blog, a screenwriting blog called Go Into the Story. It's the official screenwriting blog of The Blacklist, which is an important brand in Hollywood. It's been around for 15 plus years, so it's got a lot of information there. It's all free. And then I have a book out called The Protagonist's Journey, an introduction to character-driven screenwriting and storytelling, which is a different approach to screenwriting. It's not focusing so much on plot as it is focusing on characters and using and immersing ourselves in their lives to then drive the plot process. You can find it on Amazon and other booksellers. On Amazon, it's the number one bestseller in film and TV, and it's 5-star rated. So I'd like to encourage people Christmas time, or I guess this is going to air in January, post Christmas New Year, check it out if you're interested in screenwriting and storytelling. It's done quite well.
All right, great. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe to any podcatcher you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And you can find me on Facebook. So, Scott, you feel like coming back again tomorrow to finish off this week?
Oh, yeah. It's all been building up to this moment. I'm really ready for it.
All right. Okay, so until tomorrow, hot dog.
Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.